Alrighty, so where are we at in Doctrine and Division? We're at Pietism. Let me just take the opportunity to do a little bit of a refresher, or a little review of what the whole main thesis of Doctrine and Division is. Ever hear that expression in real estate, that the main thing is location, location, location? Well, even if you haven't, it is. Well, in Doctrine and Division, that's a little bit too simple, because location is never static. In other words, people's souls in relation to truth don't stay put. We are attracted to, in our nature, we're attracted to things we shouldn't be attracted to. And by the Spirit, we're attracted to the right things. But in either case, we're always on the move. We're always changing shape. And the thing that we're looking at is what shapes us. So a better maxim for Doctrine and Division wouldn't be location, location, location. It would be trajectory, 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 which is just location on the move. So, hey Josh, why don't you give me a good definition of what you think trajectory is? Do you know what a trajectory is?
An angle that you're going.
Yeah, almost, yeah. So I'm going to put it three times, because that's the principle here. All right, anybody else want to throw a little slightly different words in there? So if a location is here, say Boise, as opposed to here, Orlando, those are locations. But a trajectory is, yeah, that's where you are now, that's where you've been, that's where you're going. So it's a location on the move. Now, is this something you can study? If you're a meteorologist, you study trajectories, right? Trajectory of weather patterns. All right? If you're a physicist, you study trajectories, motion in general. Okay? If you're a theologian, should you be studying trajectories? What kind of a trajectory? Josiah, what do you think, what kind of a trajectory should a theologian be studying? Not in God, because God's on the move in a sense. We say that. He's creating things. He's making all things new. So there's a sense in which God is on the move, but there's another sense in which God is not on a trajectory. Nothing can be added to Him. Nothing can be subtracted from Him. He's not changing His mind. He's not changing His decrees. He's certainly not changing His nature. So God's not the one on a trajectory. So if you're a theologian, what is on a trajectory that you should be studying? What's that? My theology? Why would my theology be moving? If God's not moving, and theology is the study of God, why would my theology be moving?
Because you're changeable.
I'm changeable. I'm easily impressed by other blinky lights around my changing trajectory. And in fact, those blinking lights are pretty attractive, and I'll start going in that direction. Okay? So, the main thesis of Doctrine and Division is, number one, trajectory, trajectory, trajectory. And number two, if that's true, and on the other side of this trajectory is a cliff, this is the second part of the thesis, rescue that sheep from that next step on that trajectory. Now you realize that if you do that, if you say, number one, trajectory, 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 and number two, oh, go rescue that cliff, he's on the cliff. If you say those two things, you will be called arrogant and divisive. Why? Who are you to say that that person is, what are you trying to say, that you're better than him and you're in a better trajectory? Ooh, look at you and your trajectory. You're in a trajectory of good things. You're like on your way to an ice cream shop and that person's over a cliff because he's obviously stupid and you're smart and you're dividing up the body of Christ into all these different categories, namely you over here because you're so smart and everybody else that's on their way on this trajectory. Do you remember the biblical word we used for that bad trajectory? Started with an A. Apostasy. So here's the cliff. The word we use for that is apostasy. Now, the break from one trajectory to another is what we call division. What makes the difference? Because division will happen. What fundamentally makes it? The Word. Or, as we're calling it, doctrine. Your view toward what the Word... See, because you're going to shape... You're going to be shaped and you're going to go on a trajectory on the basis of the world that you see. If you see in that vista over the cliff that we know is a cliff, but you see like a magical land of wonderful things, your soul is going to go on that trajectory, and we're going to divide. If we know it's a cliff, I'm not going that way. Not because I don't like you, but the only way I can be good for you is to say, no, we've got to go this way. There's a cliff that way. That the result of that is a division. Okay? So this is what we're saying. Step one, trajectory, trajectory, trajectory. Step two, the result of charting that out or ignoring it is a division. Okay? And so where we're at right now is this fourth of five sections called polemical theology. We've already looked at systematic theology. In other words, we looked at this thing, systematically. We've looked at it biblically, and we've looked at it historically. And now we're looking at polemical theology. What's polemics? Argument. So it's not simply rhetoric, which is the art of communication or speaking, but it's polemical. Argumentative. That sounds bad, right? There's another dirty word. Argument. But all that means is a line of reasoning. Now, we're isolating three things in particular. The first section, we looked at the theology of N.T. Wright, not to pick on him or one guy in particular, but to talk about his influence on the emerging global social gospel. Okay? That's the first thing we looked at. And now we're looking at what I'm calling the new pietism. We introduced it on Wednesday. And here's how we basically define pietism. The word piety, that's a good thing. It's really just a synonym for godliness. So obviously, piety, good. But anytime you put that word ism on the end of anything, that starts to become a worldview, the lens through which you see anything else. And if you really harden your ism, really what it comes to mean is that that's an epistemology. It's not just the lens, it's the center of the lens. It's the thing that makes other things true. So my personal piety, and that could really mean one of two things. That could either mean my experience or emotions. So my personal subjective state. Experience or emotions. Or it could mean my good works, good deeds. But it can't mean our good deeds together as in something that we all have to be doing, because then that wouldn't be pietism anymore. So what pietism tends to do is it reduces the whole Christian faith to one's own personal experiences and emotions or good deeds. This is the secret to radical individualism in the church. The culprit of radical individualism in the modern church is not what N.T. Wright thinks. It's not the doctrine of justification by faith alone. We saw that in Wright's view, the doctrines of the Reformation, and particularly that we are justified by faith alone in the merits of Christ alone, and then his performance is transferred to us, and then it's a done deal, I'm going to heaven, I don't care about anybody else down here anymore. That's pretty much the way Wright interprets the Reformed understanding of the gospel. But what we're seeing here is that running parallel to the time of the Reformation and the Gospels is this other view that's emerging called pietism. And it first shows up in Germany among the Lutherans. And then it shows up on the American frontier in the Second Great Awakening in the 1820s and 30s and so on. At the worst, it forms cults. But even those that don't wander that far off the reservation start to interpret everything like that. In fact, even Bible study gets interpreted like that. Just me and my Bible, you know. This inner light that everybody has. So, pietism becomes a worldview. So, what do I mean by the new pietism? So, let me erase the board a little bit. After we've defined how piety gets torn from its context, made the center and turned into pietism. What happens in our day with this pietism? Well, one of the things we've already seen, and we've seen it mostly through the lens of a theologian that in many respects we like a lot, has a lot of good things to say, and that's Michael Horton. In his book, The Christian Faith in 2011, it's basically his systematic theology, he begins the book with a lot of pietistic ideas about how we know things. And I would say it's no coincidence that when he gets to ethics and politics, he takes what's called a two-kingdom view. And the two-kingdom view is not new. The language is not new. The language is biblical. So you have a city of God, or kingdom of God, and then you have a city of man, or you have an earthly city. So let's put that down here. Are these distinct? Yes. Are they divorced? No, certainly not in Augustine's view or Calvin's. Now, Luther had a lot of extreme things to say, but Luther almost never said anything that wasn't extreme. Okay, so a little context there when Luther is going from one side to another on this question. But the way that people have meant this in the past, these two different kingdoms or two different cities, is that the city of God stands over the earthly city, permeating the earthly city, that we are actually citizens of both, but that we are citizens of the heavenly city first, which doesn't make us divorce the two, just the opposite. It makes us stand over the earthly city, here's another correction, not as kings, usurping the sword, for example. In other words, all the authority structures and institutions that God set up in the original creation, we still respect, honor, do those things, submit to every earthly authority, Peter says, family, state, work, all that stuff, submit to earthly institutions. That's all correct. But we as prophets stand over the earthly city. We inform the earthly city as to what it is. The two-kingdom view today completely cuts that off and says simply that we are citizens of the two, but the one has nothing to do with the other. Now, sometimes they wouldn't say it like that, but that's pretty much what happens at the end of the day. What do you think happens to ethics down here? Because at their best, so Anabaptists thought like this, the Anabaptists of the Reformation. And so for them, joining the church meant forsaking everything in the old creation. Okay? Well, there's a truth in that. Every lie is a twisted truth. Okay? So at their best, guys like Michael Horton would still, I can show you places in his books where he would say things like this. The Presbyterian churches in the South during slavery should have refused communion to slaveholders. I agree, they should have disciplined them. But wait a minute, how do you say that? For example, how do you take a pro-life position if the Bible has nothing to say to things down here? For example, if you say, yeah, I believe in a right to life, but when John Locke used the word life, or when Thomas Jefferson used the word life and called that an inalienable right, the word inalienable is not scripture. They're not talking about the same thing as in the Bible. Really? So Genesis 9:6, when it talks about life, and it talks about the reason you don't mess with that life is because man was made in the image of God, does that mean something fundamentally different than the life that Jefferson is talking about or Locke's talking about? You say, well, Jefferson and Locke didn't mean what Moses meant in Genesis. Okay, I'll grant you that in terms of their theological justification, but isn't the life still a life? And isn't it to be defended on that very basis? So, a lot of problems here. This leads to at least moral relativism, but I would suggest a total relativism. And it's a selective relativism because nobody can live their life like that. And particularly if you're a genuine Christian. I believe there's many genuine Christians that hold this view. And oftentimes very sophisticated Christians that hold this view and simply don't think about what they're saying. And they're not trying to be relativists, but at the end of the day, that's what it leads directly to. You can't embrace a two-kingdom view by which you mean that they have nothing to do with each other and still say that this ought to be this way down here on the basis of what? If the Bible doesn't talk about that, what's your basis for proclaiming that in that sense? All right. The other thing we looked at on Wednesday was that the old view, and they would never, see, people like that will never say that Augustine or Calvin had that view, and now we're moving on to a new view. What they typically do today is they'll say that the modern church didn't actually believe the same thing Augustine and Calvin do. So these guys are returning back to the pre-modern church, okay, before systematic theologies and creeds and confessions and propositions and logic chopping and Western civilization imperializing everybody else. And they have a word for that. In the modern world, any idea that sees Christian truth as objective, as demanding something of other cultures and people, they call triumphalism. Now that's a real word that theologians use in a more accurate way. a generation or more ago. And the idea there is these words, the church triumphant or the church militant, and so on. These are states of the church, oftentimes overlapping and existing at the same time. But triumphalism is a particular view of the kingdom and the church and the last days that basically has the church acting now as if they're in their final glorified state and Christ is king and we reign and rule over people politically or militarily and we treat our words the same way. So triumphalism in this view is just treating truth in general and ethics in particular in an objective way. So the new pietism, if you want to boil it down to one thing, the new pietism is anti-objective, because again, they've reduced the Christian faith to one's own piety. Anything that we can point to, you and I together, and say, that's the truth, you and I need to bow to that truth, that's triumphalism. We're being imperialists, imposing a particular culture, the Western culture, on other cultures. Wow, this sounds so liberal. Well, guess what? The conservative church has bought it hook, line, and sinker in just the last 10 years. Very quickly. Overnight. Everybody is embarrassed and running as fast as they can from the moral majority and all that stuff in the 20th century when we were trying to destroy, you know, we had an enemies list, communism and fascism. Oh, they wouldn't say it like that. Didn't even realize how silly they're being. And actually, that wasn't a boogeyman. That was real. And Christian ideas actually do stand over those ideas and affect those things. But they said they would never say it like that. Well, that's the new pietism. One of the things we're going to talk about is the new pietism again. So that's in general. Now we're moving to particulars. We're going to talk about apologetics, and we're going to talk about political science, in a sense, ethics. Both of these things traditionally were regarded to be objective. So let's move from the general to the specific. Let me erase that now. I think we get that. Okay, so here's where we're moving. From the general to the specific. So here, truth in general, ethics in particular. So what's real and what do I do about it? Okay, what is reality like? And then how should we then live? Those are the two questions there. And both, in the traditional Christian view, were objective. In other words, truth is an object outside of me. My job is to conform to it. Truth isn't what I decide it is. It's not true only when I'm ready to assent to it. It doesn't depend on my emotions or my perspective or anything like that. Truth is objective. It is what it is outside of it. We don't make it, it makes us. Ethics, also objective. If that's true, if truth is true, then what we ought to do is also something that's outside of us. A moral law, a real right and wrong that stands over us. This is the way Paul talked about both. Romans 1:20. The invisible things of Him are clearly perceived through the things that have been made. What if people don't get the message, Paul? Romans 3:4. Let God be true, though everyone were a liar. And if that's true, then ethics, so let me put Romans 1:20 and 3:4 up here. If that's true, he says about the law, that even the Gentiles that don't have the law, he says at first they're a law to themselves. But he wasn't talking relativism. But he says, because they have the law written on their heart. Okay, their conscience testifies against them. Okay, so Paul treated truth in general, and therefore ethics in particular, objectively. This isn't a Western idea. This was Paul's idea, and it wasn't Paul's idea, but it was Christ's idea, and he was the messenger. All right, the new pietism stands against that. And we looked at a lot of ways that that was the case on Wednesday. Ended out in a little bit at sociology. We looked at those two different models for truth. One of them being the one that Francis Schaeffer had. He represented the way that truth moves through culture, or ideas move through culture, as a staircase. Basically, at the top floor, he had philosophy. What you believe about the biggest questions is going to determine what you believe about things inside of that. Okay? So if the universe is made of circles, then that particular part of the universe is going to be circular. It's just a simple matter of logical deduction. So in a post-Christian era, this means that philosophy, you're going to have a particular philosophy of what science is. If nature is all there is, that's naturalism, then the higher sciences are going to determine the social sciences. So, for example, just to show you how this works, if you believe that nature is all there is in the hard sciences, what are you going to believe about psychology, for example? What are you going to believe about the nature of the human psyche? Well, one thing you're not going to believe is you're not going to believe that it's an actual invisible soul, that it's an immortal thing, an invisible thing. You're going to believe that it's the neurons firing, and that's all there is to it, the hamburger in your head. If you believe nature's all there is, then a human being in nature is not an exception to that, but is a part of it. So if nature's all there is, and a human being is a thing, then a human being is a purely natural thing. So you have a purely physical, materialistic psychology, which is what ends you up in behaviorism in the 20th century. Okay, so that's just one way that this works. And then flows down here to high culture. And then down to the man on the street, pop culture. You say, why does any of this matter for anything? So-and-so doesn't read Nietzsche. Well, that's true, but the playwrights did, like Sartre, and everybody was reading him in the 60s, even though they were doing drugs and didn't understand what he was saying. They do read him in those plays. You say, well, nobody reads him anymore. Well, they've been adopted to movies and things like that, and so they do watch that. So this trickles down and gets to the man in the street. And that was Schaefer's point. So, what's Schaefer saying? Idea shapes world. Presuppositions shape the actions of Michelangelo's chisel and the dictator's sword. Ideas shaping culture. Well, now you have another idea, and it's also true, but it's speaking about a different thing. And if you pit one against the other, that's where you run into problems. So you'll have a guy like David Wells, a theologian, good theologian, reformed theologian, who will talk about this idea, and he's right. But then you'll have other guys like James Davison Hunter, that a lot of evangelicals, and particularly young, hip young church planters, are reading, and he'll be a little bit further on the spectrum and start to talk about this as if it is against the old idea of the big idea. The big idea shaping history, and it ought to. The Christian would say that the idea should shape the world. We're thinking more like theists when our minds shape the world. Think of Adam in the garden. Okay? We're less like humans and more like animals when stimuli makes us who we are. Naturalistic stimuli. Okay? We're more like plants or animals or passive, non-moral, non-volitional agents in the world when we allow that to happen. So this is not a theologically neutral idea here. So this is basically what the new sociologists that speak to evangelicals are looking at. They're looking at culture not as shaped by ideas, but as culture shaping idea, the other way around. So they'll look at things like commercialization in the modern world. They'll look at what that does to the autonomy of the individual, their view of their own autonomy, and that's true. And then what that means for human beings seeking their own image. Everything is reduced to a commercial event. All true. All true. In fact, David Wells and some of his books basically characterized modernity, the modern setup, and this is not so much a worldview. This is a process. He just calls it not modernism anymore, it's modernization, if you've ever heard of that word. Now you're not talking about a worldview, now you're talking about just like a reality, a plausibility structure that shapes the way we think. We're just passively, the scenery has changed, and if the scenery changes, we're not independent enough to lift ourselves above it, and it's a bit like that movie, The Truman Show. Anybody ever watch that with Jim Carrey? Okay, stuck in this world, and he's intentionally put in that world. And there's commercials and everything like that, but he doesn't understand that he's in a TV show. Okay, his whole reality is inside that bubble. Okay, he has no reference point outside of it for judging it or for trying to escape it. What is there to escape to? This is the whole world. Okay, so the idea here is that this idea of a plausibility structure is that the scenery and the world creates our ideas, not the other way around. Okay? And so Wells is looking at this, and he's admitting that in the modern world, this does have a couple of things. The modern world is marked by its impersonality. We've made some exchanges. Community is exchanged for isolation. Permanence is exchanged for transition. Excellence is exchanged for sameness, because everything's mass marketed. That's all true, and that affects the way we think. You know, for centuries, in fact, every century there's ever been up until the past two centuries, you were exactly what your parent was. And your parent was exactly what your grandparent was. There was a farmer or a shoemaker or whatever else. You walk out of your house and the only thing you ever saw was the sky. You looked down and saw some cows. And then suddenly, overnight, you can do anything you want. And you look up and see big buildings and blinking lights reflecting back at you and saying, you're the only thing that exists. If you think you're bigger than that, and you can lift yourself above, well, you can as a Christian, and you ought to. But that is not an easy process. You have to break from that machine, kind of like The Matrix or The Truman Show or one of those movies that romanticize that idea that you're in this system and you're in this machine, but nobody really believes that. They like to believe the thing they see. It's comfortable to just go with the flow. So this idea really is a true thing, but here's what they're saying now. Because this is true, this was never true. Big ideas were never meant to change the world, certainly not overnight. And this one guy, Hunter, now Wells doesn't say that. Wells says the exact opposite. In fact, Wells says this in his book, No Place for Truth. He says, since our intellectual world has died, modern life is being defined more by its social processes and cultural environment and less by any ideology. The human spirit is now being moved not by profound thinking, but by the experience of living in a metropolis presided over by bureaucracy, tranquilized by television, and awash with the racket of clashing cultures. We now experience directly the tidal surge of too much information, too many responsibilities, too much change, too many choices, and too many situations over which control has now slipped from our hands almost entirely. By the way, the bad theologian isn't the only one that's standing on these stairs and saying, see, you need to trust us to change the story. Government uses this as their leading argument. Society's too complex now. Who's going to inspect your meat? And Reagan's comeback to that was great, and more Christians should believe it. If society's too complex for all of us to be able to govern ourselves, then who among us can govern everybody else? Okay? And nobody sees the irony of it. But against this impotence of ideas in the modern idea model, Wells positions an omnipotent word coming through biblical ideas. Wells says this, I believe so little in the modern world because I believe so much in the transcendent, in God as sovereign and in His word as absolute. I believe in His power to actualize His truth in human life, even in modern human life. Okay, so you see the difference between saying that that's a reality versus saying that trumps that. This affects how we do church. Think of the church marketing guru at this point. If this is true, and therefore this was not true, how must we communicate? How must we do ministry? Answer, the person that does this the best and draws the crowd, to him belongs the kingdom. This idea, that world doesn't exist anymore, where one idea is superior to another and appeals to people on that basis. So you see what's going on here. All right, fast forward past that a little bit there. Postmodern pietism against authoritative apologetics. Now we're getting specific in the truth. Unshakable foundations. In other words, knowing why you believe, not just knowing what you believe, but knowing why you believe, knowing the foundation of your ideas, and trying to convince others of it, is now said to be arrogant and even idolatry. Horton explains, quote, listen to Horton's reasoning, the demand for absolute epistemic certainty, first of all, the demand, as if you want to prove the existence of God, for example. If you're using an argument for the existence of God, the demand, as the person studying apologetics, I'm demanding something. what, like a baby demanding for his bottle? What's the usage of that word? Look for words. Read words carefully when you're reading an author. The demand, pouty lips, banging the table, for absolute epistemic certainty not only is idolatrous in its illicit demand for archetypical knowledge that belongs to God alone, it also reflects an over-realized eschatology. That is, a premature announcement that the consummation has arrived. Wow. So that's what I'm doing. I'm going down to BSU and reasoning with unbelievers and trying to get them to see that my truth is more invincible, therefore you should believe it because of its certainty. I'm ushering in the kingdom. Really? One day, Horton says, there will be no need for faith or hope, but for now, God is still rewording creation. Question for Horton, are you certain? Are you certain that's what I mean? This is nothing less than slander. For Horton, one cannot argue for epistemological foundations, in other words, a foundation to why you believe. This one thing, you can't argue against that, so let's go from there. In Horton's mind, you can't argue for epistemological foundations that are irrefutable unless you are seeking to replace faith and hope with philosophical silencers. Now, there's more category mistakes behind this that we can delve into in this format. But notice that he calls it a demand. He's already assuming up front that there are no such truths and that those who are in favor of them are still searching, demanding for them, out on some fool's errand. In other words, his whole statement rests on the assumption that certainty equals archetypical, his words, archetypical knowledge that belongs to God alone. And that the individual who claims to perceive some certain piece of knowledge is motivated by his ascent to the heavens. Now, needless to say, I deny that. So, for one example, I deny that to refute self-creation, for example, on the idea that self-creation violates the law of non-contradiction in all possible worlds. Let me just show you, to show you my example. Self-creation is the idea that the first thing, be it the smallest molecule, caused itself. How did the universe come to be? Well, the Big Bang. Wonderful. How did that happen? How is it that on that sunny Tuesday, the law of inertia suddenly slipped? How'd that happen? Well, it's some CC is infinite density. Little magician trip. Infinite. What's infinite density? And then you get into the cosmological argument. So, and I can draw this out a little bit, but essentially at the end of the day, what's going to happen is that this first effect, whatever caused the bang, will have to be caused. Because they need the law of causality as much as we do. In order to have any science, you have to have the law of cause and effect. So if it's an effect, which they grant that it is, it has to be caused. They say, but it caused itself. So, are you saying that the cause to this effect was there and not there at the same time and in the same relationship?
Oh, yeah, that kind of sucks, doesn't it?
Well, yes, it does. It violates the law of non-contradiction. So let's get back to the point here. What Horton's saying is that that is my attempt to replace faith and hope. I don't need to hope that this guy is talking blathering nonsense. I can show it. This isn't about God as the object of faith, and now I have to choose whether or not I trust Him. Though at the end of the day, I will grant that this is part of revelation, that God, through His Spirit, is upholding these truths in my mind, and I hope in that person's mind who was formerly talking nonsense, but that he was talking nonsense is absolutely certain and irrefutable. This is insanity in the Christian conservative church. The movement away from objective apologetics, in other words, treating items that defend the faith as objective truths outside of our mind, to which you and I both have to assent to, the movement away from apologetics as objective has in its corner the finest theistic philosophers in the land. Alvin Plantinga, Nicholas Wolterstorff have made their niche in secular academia by carving out a territory for the Christian that's called warranted belief. Now, we're swimming in the deep end of the pool here. So, I'll go slow. And also, we don't have much time left anyway, so I'll just cover a little bit. Warranted belief. It's all the rage, and it has been for 20 years. And secular philosophers have conceded to, these guys are well respected in the secular community as Christian philosophers. Now, here's how it works. They basically look at a skeptical argument, most famously a guy like David Hume, talking about the problem of evil, and they basically point out that its premises are assuming too much, that it's circular reasoning, or that it's just nonsense in some way. Now, the theist may believe any number of supernatural things without having demonstrated his or her first principles, because the skeptic's first principles are illogical. So the skeptic is moving from A to B. If it turns out that that is logically incoherent, and that's good, they should do this. This part of their philosophizing is good and sound and helpful for students. Okay? Now, because the secularist has overreached here, therefore, we are allowed to proceed with faith. We have warranted belief, even if we can't prove our first premise. Now, I agree with them on that. As an act of the will, it is reasonable for me to have faith, even if I have not thought about... for example, Josiah, are you sitting here right now? Oh, yeah? How do you know that you're sitting here right now? I stumped you already? Come on, fight through this. Come on. There you go. So you're appealing to visual, to, yes, sensory things. What if this deceives me?
What?
I said, what if my senses, you said you see me, don't you? And if I say, what if my senses are deceiving me? What would you say?
You can hear me.
Ah, what if that sense of hearing deceives me? What if all five of my senses, what if it turns out, unbeknownst to you, I'm blind and deaf? And the voice you hear is actually a projection of a guy. It's kind of like Wizard of Oz. There's a guy in the other room who's going, he's like operating me like a ventriloquist. What if all that's happening? Huh? How do you know you're sitting there?
Somebody will tell you that I'm here.
Right, he will. Sure, he will. But let's say that the guy behind the curtain is, I don't know, but here's the point. You're reasonable. I'll think about that one later. I'll come up with an example. We'll use it on Wednesday, and you better be ready for that, because I'm going to ask you something about that. We'll call it the Wizard of Oz proof. but you're right. I believe you are sitting there, and I think you're reasonable in thinking so. Now, had you thought about the Wizard of Oz guy and mine not having any senses before I asked you that? Didn't cross your mind, did it? Okay. So, you are warranted in believing what you did on the basis of other things, even things that you've not thought about. Once you've thought about it, you realize, yeah, this checks out. Okay, so, all I'm saying is, as of now, it was a good belief you had that you're sitting here. It's reasonable, even though you have not checked out things that have to come before it. You see what I'm saying? Okay. You have to see everything I'm saying. I'm just saying it's a warranted belief. Okay? So, here's the value of this. The value of that is taking out the opponent's so-called logical proof that really wasn't at all. But here's what happened. And by the way, this school is called Reformed Epistemology. Interestingly, by the way, these guys started at Calvin College. Calvin College started at Calvin College. Now they're doing what all Christian colleges do. They're getting more liberal. Calvin! I've heard of him. He was also Reformed. Anyway, in the case of planning, he's teaching at Notre Dame, has been for a while now, and Walter Storff at Yale, although I don't think he's teaching there anymore. They're both, you know, a little bit older now, but for whatever reason, this school's been called Reformed Epistemology. I think they should do some more reforming. Because what happens is, this has great appeal to Christians today, because it gives us all epistemic permission. In other words, in the question of how do you know that you know, it basically declares a ceasefire and says, relax. We can all believe whatever we want to. Unless what you believe is that we can't believe whatever we want to. It gives us all epistemic permission. What it does not do is lay before anyone epistemic obligation. Christian apologetics used to be about persuading others, not about our own permission. There can be no question that this represents an intellectual retreat. Apologetics is defense by being on the offense. Doing a really mean thing of explaining to people that they're actually wasting their life because they're wrong. Because they're not just in sin, they're irrational. Sin is irrational, and therefore the two can be expected to go together. It's an intellectual retreat. But offense is offensive today. And the effect of articulating the faith in a convincing manner is tantamount to imperialism over the conscience of individuals. By the way, this affects other areas of thought. Similarities between this sentiment and Rogerian psychology, if you're familiar with that, and pacifism in ethics, and cultural relativism, should be clear. Here's the common thread. The better we perform the task of persuasion, in other words, the better we say, that's real, and you're not conforming to it right now. The better we are at that, the more arrogant we have been. You see this everywhere? You see this everywhere? We see this in titles such as John Stackhouse's Humble Apologetics in 2004. Now, look, if your point, and you should have called it something else if this was your point, so I know it wasn't, but if your point is we, the apologists, must be more humble in our disposition when we're doing things like apologetics, amen. But what's so humble? It's like humble orthodoxy. I've never met an arrogant or humble doxy. I wouldn't know what he sounds like. I've never had one from my neighbor. Never been offended by one. A doxy isn't. That's silly. Humble apologetics is the new form of the noble lie faith. Not a new idea. The old ancient Greeks and Romans had plenty of philosophers and statesmen who knew full well that the gods of Greece and Rome were figments of the poets' and priests' imagination. The pantheon of gods was upheld for another reason, because the ethics which it embodied was supposed to give foundation to social order. Many conservative-minded philosophers and social critics since then, in the modern era, have likewise advocated traditional religion, not because it's true, but because it's useful. It's the glue that holds society together. Listen carefully to Dinesh D'Souza's defenses of the Christian faith on college campuses across the country right now. It's a pragmatic. Jacob called me about this. He had a debate with a guy, I can't remember his name. The guy was an Ayn Rand atheistic objectivist debating against the Christian Dinesh D'Souza. The atheist is defending objective truth. Dinesh D'Souza is attacking it and saying we can't know whether or not God exists. And like, does anybody understand the problem with this picture? How did we get here? This noble lie conceives of the Christian God as a prop to society. Ethics. George Santayana is another such thinker who preferred Catholicism to Protestantism and preferred both over utter secularism because of its coherence at an institutional level, not because of its coherence and its accuracy in the whole thing. Now, this more palatable, gracious form of defending the faith is not pragmatic in the same way as unbelievers used to mold Christianity into its place of social utility. On the other hand, the one thing we are to avoid at all costs is the air of superiority. Just as we saw with humble orthodoxy earlier in this class, if we are referring to the disposition and the tone of the individual contending for orthodoxy, then that is exactly what we should mean. But if, on the other hand, we are talking about coming alongside the skeptic only in order to pretend with him and leave him in his pretensions, that is no apologetic at all. Now, I had a lot of other things about apologetics, its characteristics and so on throughout Christian history, but I'll leave some of that, and I think on Wednesday I'll start to get into this, down into from objective truth in general to objective ethics in particular. You're going to see the new pietism, what they're really after, is objective politics. Anything that could be formally placed anywhere on the right against anything that is slightly collectivist is the new enemy. Collectivism is in the church now. In the conservative church, not just among the liberals, in the conservative church, collectivism is in. In the new Calvinism movement, the weeds of collectivism are growing fast in the missional movement. All right, I'll open it up to questions and comments and other such things.
Isn't commercialism presenting ideas?
Yeah, so even there, if we're not a plant, now, there's, you know, Neil Postman's thesis and all those guys, to the degree that we put ourselves on autopilot, we are more like a plant when we watch a commercial. But don't we complain about commercials precisely because we are humans, because we're looking at an idea, obey your thirst, and we've got two choices. We could be more like a plant and obey our thirst, or we could be more like a human and say, yeah, there's that commercial again, giving ideas, because they are. They're presenting ideas, they're presenting worldviews, and when the worldview becomes more and more truncated and appeals more to your passions in your position, then we are more like a plant at that point. And we're less like Christians, not only less like humans. Theology is at stake here. We are less like a worshiper of God when we act more like plants in the face of culture, as opposed to resisting volitional idea confronters, which is imperialism. It's imperialistic.
So when you were asking Josiah, like, how do you know that you're sitting there?
Yeah.
So you were asking, how do you know that you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you epistemically know that he's sitting
yeah.
there? Is that
yeah.
what you're
saying? Pretty much, yeah.
He would say, well, don't you see me sitting?
Right.
And he kind of started giving you different...
And that's a perfectly good first response. And here's the thing. Here's the main problem. There's an either-or dilemma being presented to us.
So is your point, though, real quick, my question is your point that they're trying to... Are you saying this is mocking the people who are... saying, well, how do you know that?
Oh, no, at this point I'm more poking at these guys. Because they have in their minds, either I can defend to the depths and get to the foundation of certainty why I'm sitting here, which is just a mess. Then we're all going to be sitting there, afraid to get out of bed in the morning. My brother one time... Oh, I'm still recording. That's all right, Chris, you'll get a kick out of it. My brother one time mocked philosophers, by a very short extension, mocking me for having an interest in philosophy, because philosophy, there's just a bunch of people that can't get out of bed in the morning, so they don't know if the floor is there, and they can't mow the lawn, because they don't know the... Well, yes, I will grant you that is what has, you know, degenerated into that. But here's this caricature, that we either have to do this, or we can't sit in the chair. We can't have a warranted belief or action if we don't defend it to the fullest. And so the atheist is putting us on the defensive. Show me your old man in the sky. I just had that conversation on Facebook. The guy was defending gay marriage and anything goes in society, and the idea that we would, A, have... What is our argument that this violates some objective standard of morality? Don't give me your old man in the sky, pink unicorn argument. And I told him, I said, man, first of all, this pink... unicorn deity sounds very horrifying. And he said, well, that's your problem, is that you can't defend. So anyway, the idea of these guys is that we can't do this, or anything really, until we've done this. And I would suggest that's a false dilemma. I told Josiah, I said, no, it's good for you for sitting in that chair before you heard about my Wizard of Oz nonsense. Okay? You can defend as you go. Okay? But notice the Christian isn't the only one with that dilemma of having a finite mind and having to act in the world. And when you really strip it down, it's like, okay, this isn't really a dilemma. This is just part of the human condition being finite and so on. This whole thing is a smokescreen.
So basically, having to defend everything that you're believing in, is that...
They have an idea of orthodoxy, Western Christendom, that this is what we were all about. We have to defend the whole system, it's logic chopping, and everybody else just sit there until the Gnostics do their job. And everything bad in the world can then be traced to that Gnostic idea.
That's what their criticism is.
Yeah.
Even if it's not accurate.
No. Okay. Yeah. There's no relationship to any thinker that's ever existed whose writings have survived.
All they were saying is that Christianity is rational because it's true.
Yeah. It's sufficiently rational, just as much as your idea. So leave us alone. Let's all leave each other alone. Here's what they're saying at the end of the day. Okay. Hume's argument didn't add up. Well, they're right about that. And I'm glad they can make that headway in secular halls of
philosophy. They're undermining the atheist, but they're not defending...
They're really undermining the Christian, too, in a sense, because they're treating our truth as something less than objective, and therefore treating your responsibility as something less than objective. If this is true, everything else after this is bow or burn. And we can't... That undermines the gospel to say... Even, they don't know they're saying this, but this is the message you're getting. out of the other side of their mouth, they're saying, my truth is just as good as your truth. Your truth is just as good as my truth. That's what they're saying at the end of the day. Our perfectly rational foundation. We all have this kind of rational foundation in common together that none of us can get to certainty. So leave it at that. Let's move on.
So then are they calling their reform, their epistemology, reformed epistemology because, like, they think they stop the bleeding as far as...
Yeah,
like,
I think so. I think
not
so.
Because they're actually reformed theologically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, some in that group, like I said, some did come out of Calvin College, and some of them do have some, certainly, affinities with Reformed theology. They don't criticize it on the same kind of mindless grounds that you usually see out there in the church landscape. They know enough about historic theology to not do that. But they're also typically the same kind of guys that will head over heels acceptance of evolutionary theory and stuff like that.